The Urbanist is brought to you in association with the Department of Culture and Tourism, Abu Dhabi. Saadiyat Cultural District, Abu Dhabi, is a beacon of hope and inspiration. A catalyst to spark growth and collaboration with museums and experiences, where art and science and nature and technology coexist.
The belief of Abu Dhabi that culture is the backbone of our society.
Stay tuned for a special episode of the show, in which you can hear His Excellency Mohammed Khalifa Al Mubarak explain exactly why and how Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi is the perfect place to collaborate, create and innovate. Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi, proud partner of The Urbanist on Monocle Radio.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme.
The meanings attached to things can really be tuned very finely, but also leave a lot of freedom for people to begin to take new lines of flight in the way that they think about urban problems or the way that they're perceiving things.
Come with us as we take a stroll around the Urbanist Gallery to search out some of the best examples of cities we've seen through the artist's eye. From a colourful drive in 1960s Santa Monica to an avian autopsy in Chicago, we uncover how art is a powerful way to expose and assess the challenges facing our cities. So why not join me for a wander through the halls right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Welcome to the programme. This week we decided to invite you into the Urbanist's newest exhibition for a very special audio tour. Art makes us look at the world in fresh ways. It challenges our perceptions and our preconceptions. And that goes for the cities we live in too. Old paintings and photographs, for example, remind us that things were not always like this, or show us a part of our urban fabric that may have been overlooked. But most of all, art helps us to uncover some truths about where we call home. So we thought we'd use these truths hidden in art to paint a new picture of the cities that we love. And we start our tour in a quiet corner of suburbia at dusk. It's here that we get a glance of a big city issue that's often out of sight, suburban poverty. Our first exhibit is a work by the celebrated US art photographer Gregory Crewdson. Untitled, Esther Terrace is a piece from Crewdson's Beneath the Roses series and helps us consider both the camaraderie and the peculiar loneliness of the glowing porches depicted. Monocle's contributing editor, Jessica Bridger, explains more.
One artwork that I think has a particular urbanistic relevance is part of the In a Lonely Place exhibition series by the artist Gregory Crewdson. And it's from a series called Beneath the Roses, and the particular image is titled, untitled, but in parentheses, Esther Terrace. And what it is, it looks like it's either at dawn or at dusk, so it's kind of a twilight setting. And it's little two-story American-style wooden houses that look like they're very much of a middle American setting. They're not in great repair, sitting on what looks like a very lonely street with a single street light and the typical American wiring running all over the place. And Crewdson's a really interesting American photographer who's been active over the last decades. And what he does is these images that look like they might be kind of candid shots of a particularly interesting urban setting are actually highly staged and choreographed. And it's very meticulous, the amount of detail that he uses, and he'll involve fog machines and snow making and all kinds of things along with actors. And there's actually one solitary figure visible in this piece. It's a woman standing out looking wistfully from her balcony, I guess at her neighbor's windows or off into space. And there's kind of a fog in the center left of the image. Crutzen always seems to choose subjects that reflect the mundane life. His first photo series made when he was a student were photos of people who lived in Lee, Massachusetts. And Lee, Massachusetts is an old ex-industrial town. It's pretty down at the heel. And he went in and tried to record everyday life there. And I think that that's something that is still present in his work now. He often chooses these mundane urban or suburban situations that reflect an American malaise, kind of the death of the American dream. And he's said himself that he's always looking for a moment of transcendence, which is, I think, what carries these from a more photojournalistic approach or something which is kind of apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic into something that does have that transcendence, that is incredibly sad but also incredibly beautiful. This particular image was something that I saw at a photographic exhibition of Crutzen's work at CO Berlin in 2011. And this is right before CO Berlin was moved out of where it had been in East Berlin and pushed west by development. And this came out at a time when I was focused on issues about economic stability and crisis situations in the U.S. And this was after the financial crisis and around the time the Brookings Institution released a report about the suburbanization of poverty. And poverty in the U.S. was often thought of as really being an urban problem or a rural problem. But what the Brookings Institution found was that a lot of people were being pushed out of cities and into these suburban areas, which were really dramatically unable to keep up with their needs because often people didn't own cars, but there was no public transportation. People were cut off from communities and kind of isolated. And at the same time, in these suburban settings that prior to 20 years ago had been associated with American affluence and people leaving cities. And now that people are returning into cities, people are getting displaced then out of them. And this particular image was something that I used in an essay that I wrote about this issue in Topos magazine, which is the International Magazine of Landscape Architecture and Urban Design. And I used the image by Crutzen to really hit home at some of these more hard to express and more qualitative aspects of what is an economic reality for a lot of people, but is actually something that really has a very, very profound human dimension that I think often gets obscured by facts and figures and research. But in the end, an artist like Crutzen can really capture this kind of human aspect in a way that I think is difficult through words or through data. Art often can reflect aspects that are atmospheric, and this is really powerful when it comes to looking at and doing research and thinking about the urban context, because we often use words and data to describe what we see or what we're finding. But in the end, some of what we do need to examine are things that aren't so easily portrayed using the more typical qualitative means. So we have to use all of the ways possible to represent. And art, I think, is one that has a particular power to be evocative. Art can be transgressive. It can have a wealth of interpretation. The meanings attached to things can really be tuned very finely, but also leave a lot of freedom for people to begin to take new lines of flight in the way that they think about urban problems or the way that they're perceiving things. And there's also the close relationship with art and architecture. So they've always had an alignment, and they always have had also a close and complex relationship to the power structures that create them. Because both art and architecture, in the end, often need patrons. They often have audiences. People are asked to interact with them. Architecture, maybe because it's spatial, has a more direct, but maybe not as immediately evocative way of affecting people. But both really have a bearing on how people perceive the areas around them and how people come to interpret urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas, and our lives within them.
That was Monocle's contributing editor, Jessica Bridger. Next, we're off to Mexico. Our next piece is on loan to us from the Electricians Union in Mexico City. This mural from 1939 by David Alfaro Siqueiros shows us both the social inequality in the country at the time, as well as the frightening predictions of what could happen should technology and nature merge. The piece is all the more important because it was painted at a time when the government was trying to restrict artistic expression and erase some of its own oppressive past. George Kafka is a writer and editor, as well as the assistant curator of this year's Oslo Architecture Triennale. And he joined us to tell us all.
One artwork that I think is really interesting for thinking about cities is Portrait of the Bourgeoisie by David Alfaro Siqueiros, a Mexican painter. This is a mural which is actually quite hard to describe in simple terms what it shows because it's so multifaceted and complex. Put quite simply, it shows a battle taking place over various different time periods between the people of Mexico and perhaps the kind of global proletariat and these kind of despotic leaders from around the world. So there's a dictator figure who has a parrot's head instead of a human head, and he's operated by machinery. There are masses forming in the public spaces of the city. There are some heroic soldiers that are seen participating in this battle. There are scenes of strange technological creatures that are spewing coins. The image is painted in a stairwell in the building for the Electricians Union in Mexico City. And you see it as you kind of progress up the stairs. So you kind of occupy this narrative as you progress up the stairs. Siqueiros has a really interesting political history. He grew up at a time when Mexico was going through this decade-long revolution. He fought as part of that revolution. He later went to Spain to fight in the Civil War. And this painting was made in the late 1930s when he'd just come back from Spain and Franco had won the Civil War. And so it was a kind of strong, very defiant anti-fascist piece of work, which was quite typical of Siqueiros throughout his career. In fact, there's a rumour that he didn't actually finish the painting himself, because during its completion, he was arrested for taking part in an attempted assassination of Trotsky because he was a rabid Stalinist. For me personally, I have a strong personal connection to it because I've been researching it for a long time. I first came across it in 2010 when I was studying for my undergraduate degree. And I was really interested in the techniques that were used. It has this kind of strange relationship with perspective, the story it tells of Mexico and perhaps the global politics at that time. I thought about it a lot back then, and I was lucky enough to actually finally see it in real life this year, which was a truly spectacular moment. It's a strange and exciting piece of work. I've not seen many things like it, and it definitely looks like it was made more recently than 1939. Siqueiros is one of three artists in Mexico that are very famous for working on murals at the time. The other two are Diego Rivera and José Clemente Orozco. And they were all working with murals because they were these kind of explicitly public-facing pieces of art. Obviously, people have been drawing on walls for a long, long time, but they were part of a movement that was really consciously making work that would be in direct contact with the public space, public sphere. So not only with a painting such as Siqueiros's, which is at this public building, which is the Union Office for the Electricians in Mexico, work by Diego Rivera features on public walls and also in the Secretariat for Education. Siqueiros has other work at the university in Mexico City. A big part of their work was about connecting directly with the people in public spaces. I think these pieces have a really interesting connection with the city because they speak to it so directly. There's a way of interacting with it which isn't placed in a gallery. Not that there's anything particularly wrong with placing it in a gallery, but there's a different way of approaching the work in the city that these people are working with. They were, at that time, trying to reach an audience that perhaps wasn't connected with art, which was a much more elite practice at that time. This was a way of connecting with the regular people that had been fighting in the revolution and were trying to construct a better society for the masses. And I think art is an important part of the everyday life of the city. And I think by bringing that art to the people in the streets, then I think that's what they were trying to do.
That was the writer and editor George Kafka. And up next, we take a drive in Santa Monica. Stay tuned. Now we're going to take a trip back in time to 1960s Los Angeles, Pico Boulevard, to be exact. Here, photographer Denise Scott Brown's colour photography, considered non-artistic at the time, gave us a glimpse of the beauty that hides behind the chaotic nature of electric signage and roadside advertising. Gilly Merrin teaches history and theory of architecture at the Royal College of Art and takes us on a trip back in time to explore this groundbreaking work.
One work that I think is a really great example of seeing the city through the artist's eye is Denise Scott Brown's Pico Boulevard in Santa Monica from 1966. The artwork is a color photograph shot from the vantage point of the road looking into the sidewalk of Los Angeles in the 1960s. It is a head-on composition where the most prominent element is the colorful collage of signs and billboards that depict this generic scene of the American Main Street. The framing cuts most of the elements in the composition. In the foreground, we see the edge of a space-age Cadillac or Dodge and a young motorcyclist wearing a plaid shirt and looking away from the viewer. Behind them, starting from the sidewalk and into the far background, we see an incredible amount of signs with vivid graphics popping out of hot dog stands and floating billboards. It is a beautiful chaotic mix where buildings almost disappear from the city and we are left with a field of signs that seem almost flat, like a condensed pattern of colors and letters without a clear order or hierarchy. First of all, this was a color photograph, something considered second grade to the artistic black and white photography. And this colorful snapshot composition belonged to the visual realm of the everyday, much like what the photo itself shows, which is the vernacular commercial landscape of America, a place designed by anyone, basically, except for architects. And Denise Scott Brown described Pico Boulevard, the subject of the photo, as a kind of an everyday strip. The strip that she described was the cultural archetype of the American town, a commercial street that runs through an endless suburban sprawl. Motels, parking lots, gas stations, fast food restaurants, a set of repetitive roadside typologies that have always been overlooked by architects and historians. This, of course, until Denise Scott Brown and her husband, Robert Venturi, went to Las Vegas with their students from Yale in 1968. When they came back, they claimed that this marginal landscape is actually a place where we can find not only value, but also logic. So what was that logic they found in the commercial vernacular? Well, while driving through Vegas, they noticed that signs are built perpendicular to the road, while behind them there were generic buildings, or sheds as they call them. And this rather simple observation made them realize something radical, that symbols have become more important than architectural form. So essentially what gave identity to the street or the strip was not buildings, but two-dimensional signs. From here on, they understood that architecture has the freedom to be generic and its meaning can be applied as an ornament. And this design formula is what they call a decorated shed in their book Learning from Las Vegas, the forgotten symbolism of architectural form that came out in 1972. And this so-called forgotten symbolism extended beyond the graphic design of the commercial strip to include any visual communication that is set in the urban realm. It can be the facade of a Gothic cathedral or an overscaled billboard. Remember, this was the age of pop art, and the distinction between high and low was blurred. I would say that what I learned from this image of the city as seen from the car is essentially a technique for seeing things differently. I'm currently writing my PhD on the architecture of pilgrimage, and while it seems that there isn't much similarity between the American commercial strip of the 60s and the road to Jerusalem in the Middle Ages, there is something quite substantial that is similar, and that is the idea that the journey creates its own vernacular landscape. In Vegas, Scott Brown and Venturi examined the city at 35 miles per hour, and it made them see the world of architecture differently. And when I look in my research at pilgrims heading to Rome or Jerusalem, I realize that this spiritual movement altered their perception along the journey, and that my best resources is to see it through their eyes. This has led me to read dozens of travelogues written by pilgrims throughout the ages, similar to the thousands of photos that Scott Brown took along the commercial main street of California and Nevada. In the end, her series of images showed how the strip developed its own population, culture, and architecture, just like her mentor J.B. Jackson had said. And this would not have been possible if she wouldn't have spent all that time on the road documenting the vista that is open while moving. So when I look at pilgrims, I realize that the experiences collected along the way can create a meaningful sequence of representations, landscape, and even architecture. And more than that, it made me realize that the journey itself is as valuable, if not more, than arriving at the destination. Someone who was a great influence on Scott Brown and Venturi is the artist Ed Ruscha. In the 60s, he made photography books that were pieces of art in themselves, with bleak titles such as 26 Gasoline Stations or Every Building on the Sunset Strip, which were exactly that. What he did was install a camera on the back of a car and shot deadpan photographs at regular intervals. Finally, he connected all the photographs into one continuous panorama that folded like an accordion from paper. So his books were his artistic creation to a point that he didn't even take the photographs himself, but was only the choreographer. There were other artists of the time that began to pay attention to the culture developed around driving. It's something that was really uniquely American. In 1975, an exhibition called The New Topographics, Photographs of a Man-Altered Landscape, opened in Rochester, New York, focusing on the built landscape as a subject worthy in itself. Artists such as Stephen Shore, Robert Adams, and Louis Baltz photographs industrial zones, factories, warehouses, intersection, trailer parks, and the endless sprawl of suburbia as something that does not only have aesthetic value, but also reflects a topography or landscape that is the collective product of our society. What is common to all those photographers that I've just mentioned, including Denise Scott Brown, is that they created a photo that is seemingly documentary or objective, but we already know that the photographer is always subjective and that we can learn something from the way these artists or architects frame the city. Scott Brown said that she's not a photographer, but that she shoots for architecture. And indeed, she's not looking at one building or even one project, but at the city as a collective project or even a process. And this idea that space can be framed through a photograph and so be read differently is something that I think the camera gave the city. And in the case of Scott Brown, she had removed the ordinary from the borders and put it in the center, and this allowed her to see something she wouldn't have seen if she kept looking at landmarks and monuments. And what we learned from her legacy, I think, above all, is that perhaps we don't always need to be revolutionary and heroic like the modernists were, but that we can be evolutionary and learn from the existing.
That was the architect and photographer Gilly Merrin. And finally today, we finish our tour at an avian autopsy. Stay tuned. While much is said about the aesthetic damage to a city's skyline caused by towering glass skyscrapers, what is often overlooked is the impact on urban wildlife. Our last piece in the Urbanist Gallery today takes us to Chicago, where photographer Andrew Yang has produced a fascinating multimedia work about the migratory interruption for both birds and the plant seeds they carry when their journeys are cut tragically short. Our tour guide here is the artist and writer Crystal Bennis.
An artwork that I think shows a really interesting urban perspective is a work by the artist Andrew Yang, and it's called Flying Gardens of Maybe. It's actually quite a simple artwork, and if you saw it in an exhibition in a gallery, it would seem quite simple. And essentially, there are a series of photographs, which are portraits of dead birds, and they're quite common birds, things that one finds all over cities, things like robins or doves or sparrows. And then you also have some potted plants and postcards, and on the postcards are printed these seeds arranged in geometric patterns. Yang is based in Chicago, and the work has been made in Chicago, and I think it couldn't only have been made in Chicago, but I think it's really telling that he is based in Chicago because it feels like, you know, Chicago's home of the skyscraper, and it's the sort of work that I think really could have only emerged in a city like Chicago. And I think it's not until you kind of realize what's going on in terms of the relationship between these three things, between the photos of the birds and the images of the seeds and the plants and the city, that the kind of cleverness and interest of the work emerges. And the reason why I say I think a work like this could have only really emerged in a city like Chicago is because what happens is when you have all these tall glass buildings, you have inevitably hundreds of birds colliding with these glass buildings on a daily basis. And I had no idea, it was something I didn't know before I came across this work, but there's a volunteer group specifically in Chicago, and it's called the Chicago Bird Collision Monitors. It's very catchy. I had no idea that such things ever existed. Like, I don't know if there's an equivalent group in somewhere like London or New York, maybe. But they have this team of volunteers, and when they spot injured birds who've collided with buildings, they kind of rescue them, and then they attempt to rehabilitate the injured birds. And the ones that are rehabilitated are kind of set free, and the ones that are not so fortunate and die, they get brought to Chicago's Natural History Museum. And they're part of this kind of migration, data migration project. So they get cleaned and skinned and cataloged, and the kind of records are made. And so Yang's project is really involved in this strange area of bird collision. And what he found out that through speaking with the staff at the museum who's responsible for cleaning and cataloging the birds, that most of the birds are thrown away. So like the stomachs of the birds, for obvious reasons. So he had the stomachs of the birds set aside, and then dissected the stomachs. Apparently Yang trained as a biologist, which I also didn't know, which is, I think, is quite related to the nature of this project. But so he takes the stomachs of the birds that have collided with Chicago skyscrapers, dissects them, and then has taken the seeds out of the stomachs of the birds, and he's replanted them to see what germinates and grows. So the photographs of the birds are the birds who've collided with the buildings and died. The geometric pictures of the seeds are the contents of some of the stomachs of a particular bird. And then the plants are attempts to regrow, to regerminate the seeds from the stomachs of the birds. And I think it's really beautiful because the artist is kind of acting. He refers to it as the ecology of interruption when the bird collides with the building, and then the seeds carried by the bird don't have a chance to be disseminated elsewhere. So the artist is kind of acting as a chain to reinstate what would otherwise be this ecology of interruption. The personal takeaway, or the thing that really affects me about the piece, is that it really speaks to the importance of kind of maybe reimagining ourselves and cities and reimagining our conception of cohabiting in urban environments. Because I think in large cities, you know, cities like Chicago or cities like London, we're kind of constantly negotiating and thinking about ways of how we live together with other people, how we live together in close proximity. So physically how we live together with people, but also how we deal with people from different cultures and different backgrounds. But I think sometimes we forget, because we're so preoccupied with, you know, human interactions, that we're not the exclusive occupiers, we're not the exclusive residents of these urban spaces. And sometimes it's really easy to forget that. And I think one of the things I really love about Yang's piece is that it draws attention to the consequences of that forgetting, of forgetting that we have to deal with humans, yes, but we also have to deal with non-human animals in our cities and make spaces for other residents. And I think he does that in a really poetic way. I think art is very good at confronting or dealing with subjects related to our cities, perhaps because it has a kind of freedom that maybe other disciplines working in a similar area don't necessarily have. To a certain extent, I'm making, you know, massive generalization, but when you boil it down, and if you compare with something like with architecture or design, you know, those are applied arts, and they're governed by particular tools and particular parameters. And of course they can push and pull at those tools and parameters, but I think they're much more limited in their scope, you know, in terms of taking a really critical or confrontational approach. And I often think it's actually something I'm asked to give lectures to architecture students about a lot, this kind of, you know, what art can do that architecture can't do, or what art can do that architecture can do, and what those kind of weird nebulous relationships. But I certainly think that some of the most interesting commentary on our cities comes from artists. Partly because if you think of, like, well, for me, again, just speaking really personally, but like a really compelling piece of art can kind of abstract or reduce down to one super focused idea. But then that focus sort of simultaneously opens the door onto this whole world of really complex and more general ideas. And it's really interesting. So one of the other pieces that I've been thinking about, I thought kind of both simultaneously, is by another Chicago-based artist called Michael Rakovitz. And it's probably a much more famous piece. It's one of his early pieces from the late 90s called Parasite. And it's about homelessness. It's this sort of tent-like inflatable shelter structure that kind of plugs into the heat ventilation fans of urban buildings. And it kind of was everywhere. It really blew up, partly because it's a really striking aesthetic image, but also it speaks to homelessness, and that's really powerful. And I think it's such a nice example by way of comparison of what art can do that something like architecture and design can't do. And to a certain extent, it's because what I often see is if a designer or architect takes on a problem like homelessness, you know, they genuinely seem to think that homelessness is a design problem, that all we have to do is design like loads of modular sleeping pods or something and apply them to buildings, and then ta-da, homelessness will be solved. And artists, again, really generalizing, but to take the specific example of Michael Rakovitz, he's making a sleeping pod, but he's not treating the issue as a design problem. His project is about homelessness. It's a social, a political, and economic problem, and therefore it requires social, political, and economic solutions. And what he does is he uses his position and his platform as an artist to make a kind of, I guess, a protest about the social injustice of homelessness and put pressure. You know, he explicitly says he's trying to put pressure on policymakers with an impactful piece of work. And I think that perspective is something that artists often do in a way that architects and designers don't.
That was the artist and writer Crystal Benes. Well, I'm very sorry, but I'm going to have to ask you to leave the gallery now. It's almost closing time. Today's works, well, they were curated by David Stevens. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's London Grammar with Big Picture. Thank you for listening, city lovers. Only now do I see the big picture, but I swear these scars are fine. Mistakes and what you just